It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener Ufasa comes to us with our quick tip of the week, saying, I just found out that if I hover over a corner or edge of a window and see the little arrows, the ones that would let you drag or, you know, to resize the window, get to that point and then double click, it will expand the window to the edge of the screen depending on where you click. So if you click on the top edge, it goes to the top, right edge goes to the right. The top right edge goes to the top right. More quick tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab 981 for Monday, May 15th. Wait a minute, 515. Out of my brain on the 515, 2023. Welcome to Mac Geek Gab, the show where we take your tips, like the one that Ufasa sent in, and share them. We take your cool stuff found and share them. We take your questions that you send in, your questions, and we try to answer them right here on the show. We string it all together into an agenda to make a little sense of it, but also to ensure that we reach our goal. It's more of a system where we make sure every single one of us learns at least five new things every single week when we get together. Sponsors for this episode include private internet access. We're at PIAVPN.com/MGG. You can save 82% off your VPN service plus 4 free months. BB Edit is our second sponsor for this episode. My favorite text editor. It's open right now on my computer because it's always open on my computer. We'll talk more in depth about both of those things a little bit later here in the show. For now, here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, back in Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
And guten Tag from Köln, Germany. It's Pilot Pete. Great to be back with you guys. And I got to say, that quick tip you just shared, instantly in my workflow.
Right? Yeah. I need my fingers to learn that because I want to be able to do it all the time.
So. I tried it a couple times and I found myself just doing it yesterday naturally.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's great. All right. John, you got a quick tip from listener Jim, I think?
Yes, we do. So Jim says, in your most recent episode, you talked about smart folders for Apple Music. That got me to thinking of something I've been doing in Photos that might be helpful to others who, like me, insist on having albums for all of their major trips and events. Yeah, I got to keep up with that, man.
Same.
Going through old photos is sometimes painful because it's like, which one do I get rid of?
Yeah.
And if you don't get rid of it, then you're going to consume all space, which is what computers do. So anyways, I create a smart folder for each year to identify all of the photos that are not in an album. The folder parameters are that the photo is not in an album and that it falls within a year-specific 1 January through 31 December date range, one for each year in my Photos library collection. I then periodically review that smart folder and move the photos that should be in an album to the appropriate place. That makes sure that I always have all the photos I want in a specific album in the right place. That's probably an obvious thing. No, not really. But it sure saves me a lot of trouble.
Huh. Yeah. Okay. Like this solves that problem that you just articulated, John, where it's like, I got to go through things by showing that, but that smart album and having the key of it not being in any other album is effectively, I mean, it's an unfiled photos album, right? I love this.
That's actually pretty cool. I hadn't thought of doing that. Most of mine are, you know, our photos, generally speaking, are in chronological order.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, yeah, at least that's the way my photo album is set.
Yeah, same.
So I do have some that are weirdly, you know, 15 years out of sync. It's like, no, wait a minute. There's no, you know, my son was 17 at the time. There's no way that, you know, here it is 10 years later.
Yeah.
When he was 5.
Right.
Okay, 12 years later. Do the math. But Yeah. So, but that's pretty cool. I'm going to play with that a little bit. And...
yeah. I like this idea. This is good. Yeah. Yeah, knowing the other thing that you mentioned, knowing which ones to delete, I find that my iPad is the right device for me to triage photos. And I have it on my calendar to do it once a month for the previous month, because that way it's not too overwhelming. But my iPad, because the screen is, it's bigger than my phone, so I can actually see some detail there, like I could on my laptop or certainly on my, you know, desktop or whatever. But being able to touch the pictures and like moving around, like that user experience on a larger screen than a phone, but still with the touch interface, is really the right way, because I can just swipe back and forth really easily and see, okay, I took four pictures here. Yeah, two of them are crap. Two of them are great. All right, delete, delete. Good to go. But then once I'm done with that, going through and like filing them, this is the great tip. I wish there were, and I know Apple's got ways, and my guess is with more and more, you know, AI or machine learning or whatever we want to call it, like it will get better at saying, okay, here's the 16 photos that are basically the same thing. Pick, you know, let me help you pick the ones that you should keep and we'll jettison the rest. Like, you know, get rid of the blurry ones, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you folks do this, because I think like clearly all three of us, like this resonated with all three of us instantly. So I think this is, we always say we put things in the show that hit the 20% rule by that, I mean, it's relevant to at least 20% of you folks listening. Right. I think this one probably hits the 90% rule, or at least the 70% rule.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious how you folks do this. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com. Let us know. Post in Discord at MacGeekGab.com/Discord.
I'm certain he just said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
No. He said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
Okay.
Interesting.
Okay.
Interesting.
Now just put keyword managing on the iOS devices so we can do that with photos. That's asking for too much, I'm sure.
Nitpicking, isn't it,
Pete? Yeah, I know it. Yeah. I know it. I love me some keywords.
Yeah.
It helps.
Yeah.
It helps.
Yeah, for sure. All right. You got a quick tip from Martin, Pete?
Oh, I'm coming.
Okay. We've moved our workflow from Evernote to Notes. If you hear some hiccups here, that's why. I'm not happy about Notes, though, because there's no obvious, easy way to export Notes. I can export as a PDF, but that's not what I would want. If I want to move to a different Notes app, I want to be able to export in like ENEX format. So I need to see if there's like, clearly there could be an Apple script that someone's written to do that. I just got to find
Just briefly, Porthos John mentioned something, and now I don't see it in Discord. I'll have to go back to it. He mentioned a Notes app that he likes. So we'll have to look back at that in a second. But so I found it. I'm sorry. I just was behind the Obsidian, he says.
No, wait. We're going to have this conversation. There's no way that I'm moving to some obscure note taking app. I thought a lot about this. This is and I actually had a conversation with one of you, a listener, called me this week. We had this conversation. If I am going to store, just like with mail, but mail's a little different because mail's now all IMAP. So you could use some obscure mail client and not risk losing access to your stuff. You just have to move to a different client, right?
What he said when he initially said is, hey, this stores it in Markdown.
Still, custom format. Right? Like, if I'm going to use a note-taking app, it's either going to be the one that Apple provides so that when operating system updates happen, they are likely, in fact, almost guaranteed to be up to date unless they just jettison notes, right? So it's either going to be Apple's or it's going to be the market leader, which of course is Evernote, and Evernote doesn't work for us anymore because they don't support AppleScript. So this is why it became Notes. I've thought a lot about this. I don't want to use as good as any of these other solutions might be, if it's developed by a solopreneur or a small development team or something,
you could get left hanging.
The other option would be Microsoft OneNote. Although Microsoft has been known to leave people hanging too, despite being a very, very large company, but I don't think they're going to leave OneNote hanging. I think enough people use it. So maybe OneNote is the option here, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, there are thoughts that go through Dave's brain sometimes.
Right. There we go. So, all right. Well, we're off of that detour now and then back on, which I created, by the way.
It's a good one.
Yeah. So we got a quick tip from Martin, and he writes, you probably already mentioned it, but I thought I'd send it anyway. Rather than having to go to settings to connect to Bluetooth devices, you can go to the control center and long press on the rectangle containing the Bluetooth icon. This brings the whole rectangle forward, including cellular, Wi-Fi, personal hotspot, etc. Long press the Bluetooth icon, and it brings up the list of Bluetooth devices you've connected in the recent past. Touch the device you'd like to connect to, like wireless earbuds, and it connects. The same goes for the Wi-Fi icon. Much faster than having to go find the settings icon, open it, scroll down to the... Used it. That's the second one. Like the first one in the show opener. I have used that all week long, and I'm loving it.
Yep.
Very cool, Martin. Thank you.
Yep.
Pretty much anything in Control Center, if you hold down on the icon, interesting things will happen, like the flashlight, for example. If you hold down on it, you will get a selectable brightness.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I like this network Bluetooth thing, because you can keep, like you said, you keep long pressing and it goes even deeper, right? Like
drills that's down.
Yeah, drills down. Yeah, yeah, I like it. Yeah, it's good.
Instead of having to search for it. But you can, that's the other one, and I know I shared this a long time back. If you do go into settings, pull down briefly and you get a search window at the top, and you can write in the setting for which you are searching, and it will quickly get you. Rather than having to scroll down, 50 apps looking for something.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, fair. So, yeah, yeah. Sorry, my brain doesn't seem to want to stop this morning. We were talking about notes. No. And one problem that we noticed this morning was that if one is not very aware of what the focus is in notes, if you could be in a scenario where you think you're deleting a note, but instead you're actually deleting the notebook. And both of them have confirmation dialogues that look very similar, and that's dangerous. And so I got to thinking, it's like, well, wait a minute. What if we wrote a script that only would delete the note? Like, even if you were selected on a notebook, it would go through. Like, you could do this with user interface scripting with AppleScript. And then what if we use something like Keyboard Maestro to intercept that delete keystroke when you're in the Notes app and not fire the notes delete function, but to fire a different delete function, right? Like, I think there's a world here where that's doable. I'm on tangent mode today.
I'm trying to start more, learning more scripting, because I'm beating my head against a brick wall, even with chat AI. Which we'll talk about more later in the show. I know.
I think so. Yeah. Well,
it's given me scripts that work, and it's given me scripts that don't work, no matter how many times I ask it in how many different ways.
Fair. Yeah, we've got something coming up a little bit later that I think will be good for that. But yeah, we will keep moving on here. Listener Tim has a quick tip for us. He notes, no pun intended, that if you... He says, I found this by mistake, but it's pretty cool. If you're in Safari on the Mac and you press Command I, it will create a new email message with the web page you were on and a link to the web page. So it actually embeds the web page in the email and puts a link to the web page that you were on. This can be handy. And I don't disagree. Like, these are good quick tips. Yep. That one, I don't know. I've done this accidentally too, Tim. I don't know that my fingers will ever remember it. They might now that we've actually talked about it here, but I know that it exists, right? So I know that I can be in Safari and go to like the file menu and find, the share email this page. Oh, it's Command I. Okay. But I could just choose it from there. Like I know that the functionality is there. So I can do it. I don't know why it's Command I, probably because others were taken, because like Command M is minimized. But you could change that, right? You go into settings keyboard and you can start monkeying with all that stuff per app or system wide. Yavel. You got another one from Thad? a follow-up maybe to last week's thing, Pete?
I kind of do. He wrote and was it last week? Whichever week it was. I've lost track of it. The point is, we were talking about
time anyway? It's just this abstract concept for our feeble human brains.
Right. It's not linear.
Linear time is absolutely something we made up. There's zero question of that. Well, we're not smart enough. Like our brains don't have the capacity. I don't want to say we're not smart enough. Our brains don't have the capacity to truly see time for what it is. So we came up with linear time. It's fine. It works. It's a good construct. We all got here in sync with each other at the same moment in time to do the show. And that's a wonderful thing. Yeah. Speaking of doing the show, did you have something from Thad?
I did. And we had talked about previously or in the future, we're going to talk about it, depending where on the time scale you are. I could not remember why I did not go to an eSIM in my phone.
Right. Oh, right. And
yeah. And I was like, I know there's a reason, but it escapes me what it was. And he wrote in and said, yeah, here's what it is. And I think he was off by one number, but iPhone 12 and earlier, you can have a physical SIM and an eSIM. And that's it. And if you go to an eSIM, your only other option is to have a physical SIM. So when I travel, I would no longer have the ability to use an eSIM. So that was the reason. Thank you, Thad, for reminding me why, in fact, I didn't go to the eSIM option, because I am on a 12 Pro Max. And for those of you on 13s and 14s, I think the 13, Dave, you in the reply you said, has both a physical SIM and two eSIM slots.
Yeah, so the 13 sort of lives in both worlds, right? Because with the 12 and earlier, but not all the way earlier. I think eSIMs began with the 10R, right? And in those scenarios, up through from the 10R up through the 12, you have the ability to simultaneously use two SIMs as long as one is a physical SIM and one is an eSIM. The iPhones 14 and further, at least those released here in the United States, do not have a physical SIM slot. So you can use two SIMs at a time. And by nature of physical limitations, they must both be eSIMs, because those are the only kind of SIMs you're going to use. The 13 lives in both worlds. The 13 has a physical SIM slot. You can use the physical SIM slot with one eSIM, or you can use no physical SIM slot and two active eSIMs. And I insert the word active there because I think you can have, and it really depends, and no one really seems to have a specific answer on this, but I think you can have up to about 10 eSIMs loaded on your phone at any given point in time. Only two can be active, though. Two SIMs total can be active. So with the 13, it could be two eSIMs or a physical and a regular eSIM, and then, moving forward with the 14th. So yeah, we took a very simple thing and overcomplicated the heck out of it, but you're welcome.
Yeah, right.
When I first got my 12 mini, I called Verizon and I'm like, hey, can you make this an eSIM instead of a physical SIM? Well, first when I got the phone, I put in a 5G SIM and then it's like, or I put it, it had my old SIM and it's like, no, you got to get a 5G SIM, go to the Verizon store. But then after that, a couple of years later, I got curious and I'm like, I wonder if they have their act together, and called them up, got to a certain support person, and they're like, what's your IEMI or something like that? And it's on an eSIM.
Yeah.
I don't know, just because I still have the old SIM if I want to go back to it. But
no, generally speaking, once a SIM is retired in a carrier's system, it is like there is no world where it can be reactivated. So my guess is that SIM is and should be trash. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's every carrier that I've ever been with has explained that to me. They're like, oh no, once we deactivate it in our system, it's never coming back online.
But they could make me a new one that has my same number if I wanted to, right?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yes. Yeah. It's not like you're losing your number or anything. No, it's just that physical SIM is, and then what I did was
run the T-Mobile test drive.
Yep.
The problem is you got to manually switch between your different lines, which is what I did until the trial ran out. So
only if you want to, the iPhone, especially now, is pretty good at having two active SIMs. Like when I'm in, you get to decide what SIM is used for what purpose. So when I'm traveling, you know, elsewhere, that isn't the United States or somewhere that I need to use another SIM, I'll put an eSIM in, but I'll tell it only use the eSIM for data, for phone calls and SMS. Yep. Still use my main SIM, right? And not my travel SIM, but you can control it per contact too. I could say, when I call John, because he's in the United States, use my US SIM. But when I call, you know, my daughter, because she's in Italy, use my European SIM that I'm here for, right? Like you can do all that. And you can even tell it switch automatically, choose for data, choose the SIM that is workable and doesn't force me to roam in whatever environment I'm in. Doesn't really help if like your case, you've got two SIMs that are both built for the US, but you just set it. And then when you deactivate that SIM, it'll say, do you want me to go back to the other one? It's like, yeah. So,
and the other cool thing about that is that at least what I did when I switched over to Mint Mobile, I put an eSIM in my phone and I tried it for a week to see, do I have the connectivity I want? In other words, I don't want to get this service if where I live, it's going to be crud. And so I did that, and that was nice. So people realize if you're thinking of switching to somebody else, try an eSIM in your phone.
Yeah.
And make sure you're getting the service you want. Once you realize you've got it'll give you the service, then you can use my reference link.
So, that's true. That's fair. Go to, I'll round robin. I'll include you in the round robin of that. Mint Mobile used to be a sponsor for years, but it's been a number of years since they have. Obviously, yeah. Pete and I still use it because it's the least expensive thing. But they do often have like a referral deal where the person who referred you gets something, but so do you, right? And so I have a link set up called MacGeekGab.com/Mint Mobile. And I think that's right. I'm making sure it is. And it is set up on a round robin to give those of us here that use Mint Mobile the referral credits when you're signing up. So I will add, give me your thing, Pete, and I'll add you to the round robin on that too. Yep.
Thanks.
Yeah, man. Of course.
Kidding, but that's awesome.
No, it's totally fine. Just to wrap that up. Let me make sure I have these links right. Just to wrap all this up. The advice that I would give is if you are on a 12 or earlier, iPhone 12 or earlier, I would, generally speaking, there's always going to be asterisks to this. If you're on a 12 or earlier, I would keep your main carrier on a physical SIM and leave your eSIM available for your traveling, you know, for flexibility when traveling. Because like the eSIM when traveling is absolutely the way you want to go. You don't want to have to mess with that. However, if you have a 13 or later, I would absolutely move everything to eSIM because that way you don't have to deal with physical SIMs that are getting out of date or going bad or any of those issues. You just get to completely walk away from that. Obviously, if you have 14 or later, you don't have a choice in this matter. But 12 or earlier, keep your main service on the eSIM or on the physical SIM so that you have the eSIM as an option when you travel. And then 13 or later, just go eSIM all the way and you're good to go. So
I'm waiting for the 15 to upgrade, iPhone 15. It's coming soon. There you go. 5 short months.
Five. Yeah, I think that's maybe even less, maybe 4 short months. Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be good.
Yeah. Yeah. What's next, John?
Larry gives us a warning here. Mark Zuckerberg warns not to screenshot your Facebook chats.
And why is that?
What he's really saying is that they're constantly making improvements to the Facebook Messenger app.
Sure.
Well, one of the enhancements is going to be if you identify a message as disappearing, which I think other platforms can do as well. If somebody takes a screenshot, you will be notified.
Oh, sure. That's actually been in Facebook Messenger for years. You can do private chats that, yes, are disappearing like Snapchats or whatever. And And so like Snapchat, they're going to tell people that you screenshotted their message.
Yep.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah, that's fine. Sure.
So,
yeah.
And actually, Larry makes an interesting speculation. What if I take a picture of my iPhone screen with my iPad?
Well, so
that's the that's the analog attack.
Yeah, that's the workaround. Yeah.
They're not going to know you're taking a physical picture. Or at least I hope not.
Yeah, that would be interesting. No, they wouldn't. Yeah, apps can subscribe to an API that essentially fires, an event to them when a screenshot is taken when the app's in front. So I've seen it a lot in like beta apps that I'm using. If I'm testing something for someone, if you take a screenshot, it says, "Oh, do you want to submit this screenshot as a bug report?" It's like, "Oh, what a handy little thing." Like, "Yes, I do." And, off you go. So, yeah. Anyway. Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
But yes, good to know that they're doing that. My guess is it would tell you that you are, that the other person is now knowing that, but which I think Snapchat does, but maybe Snapchat doesn't.
No,
maybe.
Snapchat does.
Well, it tells the other person, but if you and I are on Snapchat and I screenshot something you sent me, does it tell me that it just told you that? Or does it only, you know what I mean? I forget because I know it's something that I know happens. So I forget if it actually tells me.
Yeah. I don't remember. Cause I don't think it does because I do remember taking, my daughter was sending me some stuff and I remember screenshotting it. She goes, "Why are you screenshotting that?" I told her I'm doing this and you're in trouble now. And, but I'm like, well, I wanted that information. So thank you. And that'll allow me to save it.
She's right.
Like, oh, okay.
Right.
But I don't remember it telling me that. So I think.
Yeah, maybe not. Huh? Yeah. Interesting. All right. One last little quick tip ish. We started talking about it earlier in the quick tip section here, so I'll happily share it. Patrick says he refers us to a recent episode of the Accidental Tech Podcast where they were talking about current day AI and basically saying that these chatbots are a tool that can scrub a gigantic data set, a large language model, and organize that in a way that we can understand very well. And it seems like it's talking to us or communicating well with us in our language of choice, but that it can't actually, the engine can't actually think for itself. That's a good way to think about it. I've had two friends share things about along these lines recently with AI chatbots, which again, I'm very bullish on. We use them constantly here to produce the show and get stuff out. And it's really helping do a lot of the grunt work, if you will. A good friend of mine, Chuck Schotten, friend of the show as well, described these AI chatbots as Dunning-Kruger implemented in software. Dunning-Kruger meaning implying that it is an entity that speaks confidently without knowing whether or not it is correct, right? So it doesn't have enough knowledge to vet what it's telling you. So it could be strong and right. It could also be strong and wrong.
Here it is, Dave.
What's that?
Show title.
Strong and wrong?
Often wrong, but never in doubt.
Often wrong, but never in doubt. Yeah, right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, strong and wrong. Yeah. Which, is a thing. Another friend, actually, David Sparks, right? From all that he does for Mac Power Users and Mac Sparky and all that stuff, described these AI chatbots as a fantastic intern, right? And so I think they're both correct. Like these are good ways to think about it. And if we combine those two and sort of go all old school on it, I would describe these AI chatbots as fantastic temp workers, right? Because every day someone new shows up at your office that has some skills that you can leverage, but you have to give them all the instructions of what to do. And then you have to vet their work to make sure that it is what you wanted them to create and that it is accurate, right? So for example, I use these chatbots I use ChatGPT to take the agenda, and I'll do it after we finish this episode. I know what we talked about because we have the agenda items. I feed that into ChatGPT and I tell it, please make me a blog post based on this. And it does. It, instantly I have a 7-paragraph blog post. I then read that and I tweak the things that it got incorrect. It might say on this one, for example, it might say, Patrick asked the nerd, your favorite geeks or whatever, to describe the current state of AI chatbots. Well, that's not what happened. Patrick.
No, it definitely will, because you just said that.
But it's not getting the transcript.
No, that's
it's
true. It's not doing the transcript.
Literally, yeah, I'm true. Just giving it the agenda. So I'm not giving it very much to begin with. And therefore, it doesn't know if Patrick asked or Patrick shared. Right. And so I do, or at least I will when we finish the show, and I can go quickly and you know, clean that stuff up. But the fact that it wrote 7 paragraphs for me, way easier to edit than to write from scratch, as evidenced by almost 18 years of never writing these things from scratch. So, bingo. yeah, bingo. All right, look, when we go online, whoever manages the network or whoever owns the network can see what we're doing. That means your ISP knows literally everything you do online. It's true, right? It's kind of like handing your laptop to a stranger and opening up your browsing history. And this is why having a VPN is essential. And I want to tell you about one of the best VPNs out there and easily one of the most affordable ones I've seen. And the one that I use, as we've talked about here on the show, PIA. PIA stands for Private Internet Access. And they take privacy seriously. Not only does PIA hide your IP address, it encrypts your entire connection. And PIA is also the world's transparent VPN. They never record or store user data. And their no logs policy has even been verified in court. I use PIA. We went through this last year. We checked them all out. And PIA is the one that I use primarily. We were just talking about this on a recent episode. Listen, right now, go to PIAVPN.com/MGG to get a whopping 83% off your VPN service, plus 4 free months with a 2-year plan. It comes out to just over $2 a month, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's PIAVPN.com/MGG for 83% off private internet access. PIAVPN.com/MGG. And our thanks to PIA for sponsoring this episode. One of my favorite apps, it's installed on all of my computers, is BBEdit. In fact, it's running right now because it's part of my start the day script. I know this sounds crazy that a text editor is super important, but it is. Now, obviously, if I'm going to be doing some programming, well, BBEdit's where I go, right? That's not the only thing BBEdit does. In fact, it does so many things with text. We were recently talking about how great it is with regular expressions. Its find and replace is fantastic. You can do things in multiple files at the same time. I use BBEdit. I was just using it yesterday to compare 2 documents. There was a change to the software that builds our RSS feed for this podcast, and I needed to make sure that the software changed things properly with an update. And so I pulled down a copy of our old RSS feed and I pulled down a copy of the new one, you know, before and after the change. And then I pulled them into BBEdit and had it show me not just line by line, but character by character where the changes were. It makes it so easy. All this and more. You got to go check it out. Go to barebones.com. You get a 30-day free trial. That 30-day trial gives you all the features. And then after 30 days, some of the features go away, but some of them actually stick around. But you're probably going to want to support Barebones, unlock it, and get all the features. So check it out, barebones.com. And our thanks to BBEdit for sponsoring this episode. And listen, while I have you here, I want to tell you about a show. When the New Yorker magazine asked Mark Zuckerberg how he gets his news, he said the one news source he definitely follows is TechMeme. For 4 years now, the TechMeme Ride Home podcast has been Silicon Valley's favorite tech news source. The podcast has become so successful, in fact, that it launched a venture fund where the listeners to the show are the limited partners in the fund. The TechMeme Ride Home is like TLDR as a service. It's not just the latest headlines from the world of tech. It's also the context around the latest news of the day. It's all the top stories, the top posts and tweets and conversations about those stories, as well as behind the scenes analysis. I listen to TechMeme Ride Home now, and I love it. It's fantastic. It's really tight and well done. Guests who have come on to lend their experience and expertise include Andreessen Horowitz's Chris Dixon and Bloomberg's Apple Rumor King, Mark Gurman. Folks at TechMeme are online all day reading everything so they can catch you up. So listen to the one podcast anyone who's anyone in Silicon Valley listens to every single day. Search your podcast app now for Ride Home and subscribe to the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast. And our thanks to them for doing this swap with us. All right. We had Jens24 in Discord asked, I've changed hard drive icons on Macs before, but today I used the procedure I always use, which is to copy the drive icon to the clipboard and then go to get info of the drive. So highlight the drive in the Finder. And this is a quick tip for those of you who don't know how to do this. You get a picture on your clipboard and then you go to the Finder, highlight the drive, go to get info, either with Command I or File get info, and then click in the upper left-hand corner, paste. Once you've highlighted that, Command V will paste what's on the clipboard. So hopefully the image you want in, and usually in the process, it converts it to the drive icon and does what it needs to do. And, Bob's your uncle. Everything's good. Jens24 says that doesn't work anymore. Any idea why? And so my question starts with what were you copying from? What was on your clipboard? Because I'm guessing that there is some sort of, data filter that says, well, if it's just some text, obviously we don't want to put that there. So it just ignores the paste and does nothing. Right. That would be my guess. So I would say, what's on your clipboard? And you can answer this question for yourself. You go to Finder, in the Finder, go to the Edit menu and choose Show Clipboard, and it will display to you the contents of the clipboard. Or if it can't display them to you in a like quick look type format, it will at the very least describe as best it can what sort of data is there. And maybe that's what I would do. You know, we approach a lot of these questions if I was there, what would I try next? And that's what I would try next is, okay, what are you trying to paste? What is it seeing when you say Command V and go from there? Another way to test this would be to grab a known good icon. How could you find one of these, you might ask? Well, go to another folder or an application and do the reverse. Get info, click and highlight, and do Command C to copy it to the clipboard. Then try pasting that in on your drive icon just to make sure that the functionality is still working on your computer. And then you know it's a data issue. And so whatever format you have the image in, try something else. I know that PNGs have worked for me in the past, so that would certainly be a way to go. It could be that you might have, say, a live photo or something on your clipboard, and maybe that paste functionality hasn't been updated to use that. I don't know, but that's where my brain goes on that stuff. How about you guys?
You got something, John? I do.
I like the clipboard tip, and I just looked at it. So for example, what I have in the lower left-hand corner, it says text.
Okay.
It's on there right now, so that's neat.
But does it show you the actual text? It should.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Okay, great. Yeah. Okay. Right.
But no, I think you're right. If you try to paste a movie, it's like, I don't know what that is.
I don't know how you want me to convert that to an icon file. Right. Yeah.
I mean, my guess would be, just take the first frame, but maybe that's not a good guess. I'll have to try it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We don't know. Yep. How about you, Pete?
So my multitasking, I may have missed something here. And the question is, because as you started talking about it, I went, I didn't think so, but okay. So as people may know, I name my various drives after military aircraft. It just helps me keep, so sure. My main hard drive, as one might guess, is Harrier. Well, what are the odds? Right.
So, is that always the name of your main drive, regardless of computer?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes. So when I buy a new laptop, I'll call it Harrier, but Cobra was one of my Drobos. I've had Phantom, Intruder, and all the different military jets and helicopters and that sort of thing.
But yes. No, see, I like
exactly
this.
What's where.
Cause I name mine after Miles Davis songs, but Miles Davis is no longer with us and therefore no longer writing songs. And so there is a finite list of options for me. And I decided years ago that I would never name two drives the same. And so I'm moving on to a different paradigm.
Oh, interesting. So your main laptop drive changes names every time you change.
Correct. Oh, and okay. If the drive in my laptop or my desktop were to die, and I were to replace it, the new drive would have its name. Like,
okay.
I don't know. You know, it's just me. Like, I mean, I'm not saying that my system is probably far more complex than it needs to be, because I like yours. I can't migrate to yours, obviously, because I can't, like, there's no way that would work for my brain to have two drives with the same name. But I love that it works for your brain because it makes your life easier than mine.
Well, you could if your main laptop is always your main laptop.
No,
and
I get
you
that.
Get rid of one, and you know, but you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So here's where I'm not sure if I missed something or not. I hope I didn't. But what I did, as you might guess, I do have a couple of pictures of Harriers on my aircraft or on my aircraft on my laptop, and so I went and pulled. I did a quick view. And then I did a quick screenshot of it. Then I went to my main drive, which I hadn't done this before on this particular machine. I went to the drive. I highlighted it. I hit Command-I. And then in the little icon up there, I clicked it with the mouse and then or the trackpad, and I hit Command-V, and it changed. So did I hear in the question, you can't change it anymore?
No, you can. Whoever it was.
That's what I missed then. Okay.
Yeah. Jens24 was just saying they can't change it. And we're asking why. And so you absolutely can. Yeah. Okay. Now, if the drive is mounted read only, then you can't change it, right? If you don't have administrator rights to the drive.
If you're running which is a good security thing to do, right? Have two accounts. One's an admin account, and run your life from a non-admin account so that it forces you to put in your password to make admin changes. But you would think it would ask, if you want to do this, you need an admin password or not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know. We'll find out.
I got nothing else.
We got nothing else. That's right. John, you want to take us to Joe?
Yes, Joe, thank you. Joe says, I took my first long 3-week trip to Europe since the early days of the pandemic. And after hearing Dave's recommendation of esimdb.com, bought a 10 gig eSIM for the trip. Using the app from the eSIM provider, I was surprised at the quick rate of data usage. At home, I rarely go above 4 or 5 gigs per month. After checking in settings cellular, I realized that the culprit was photos. In the U.S., most of the photos I take are at home or nearby, and I don't take that many. But as a tourist, I take a ton of photos, and I like to take raw photos. Before I decided to check, I used almost 5 gigs of data sending my pics to the cloud. As you can imagine, I turned off cellular data for photos and for Overcast, another heavy data user. And then I sent him a follow-up. So yeah, setting cellular shows you the data consumption.
Right.
Now, the thing is, there's something on the bottom of that screen that will show the amount of data used per period.
Right.
Now, you may ask yourself, how long is a period? And I found an article that addresses this. And the answer is, it depends. You can either do it manually, and I found it, at least on my phone, the last time I did it was 2020.
Okay.
So I should probably reset it.
Sure.
But they claim that certain carriers will reset that statistic as well. I think they have the ability, but they may not do it.
Interesting. It is different per SIM. Like your data consumption, like in Joe's case, because he said he had his two SIMs, it will show you your currently selected data SIM, but it does keep track on a per SIM basis, so you know what you're using on each of those SIMs. So for him, putting a new travel SIM in the current period was probably days or maybe a week, right? Because he had just added this SIM to the phone. However, photos was still taking up all this data. So it was actually photos using this, not just looking at the, you know, grand sum total of 3 years worth of data or something misleading him. And this brings up a piece of advice that I'll share that I certainly follow, but have never thought to share on this show. And that's when I do this for all of my SIMs, including the one that I have in there currently as my standard SIM. But I make a point when I go and add a new data SIM for travel or whatever, I go in to settings, cellular data option, and I go into data mode and I set low data mode, because that way it would keep many apps from doing this. Photos is certainly one of them. It will not send you do your photos syncing in the background over your mobile data. It would wait until you were on Wi-Fi to do that. Overcast should respect that choice. In the past, there was a bug where it did not, but I think it's back to respecting that choice now, which is good. And Overcast also has some granular settings in the app where you can tell it what to do on cellular versus not cellular, we'll call it. But yeah, and I wish there was a way to tell my phone to do this by default, to use low data mode when I put a new SIM in or something. Like, that would be handy. But there's not, and you don't even get a warning like, hey, you put a new SIM in, would you like to enable low data mode on it? You don't get that option. So it's just something we all have to remember to do manually every time you add a new eSIM.
And as someone commented, you know, with bandwidth nowadays, you can go through an entire month's data in about 2 minutes. So,
oh yeah. Especially if you're doing speed tests, man. Like, yeah. 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 Speed tests on 5G will chew data. Yep. So yeah, just bear that in mind. That's yeah. So with Joe, it was less about the definition of a period. It was truly that Photos was just chewing up his data, because it was on his new travel SIM. But unfortunately, that's kind of how it goes. Thankfully, I know Joe's from the United States. We here in the United States have one of, if not the most expensive per gigabyte data rates in general. Obviously, you can, you know, you go with the major carriers like AT&T or Verizon or whatever, you pay a fortune for it. Even with the, you know, the discount carriers like a Mint or, you know, Xfinity Mobile or any of those, like they're way less than half the price of what you're paying with the majors. But they're still ridiculously more than everybody else in the world pays. And that's just how it be. So I say this because I've always thought, well, if I'm traveling and I screw this up and, you know, wind up using way more data than I anticipated and need to re-up, at least I'm not re-upping at U.S. rates. I'm re-upping at, you know, European rates or Mexico rates. Mexico is actually pretty expensive, at least compared to Europe.
Yeah.
Probably because of its, you know, proximity of the border to the U.S.
I remember the first few months of the iPhone, though, back in 07. Wow. There were people coming back from overseas with, you know, $3,000 bills.
Oh, yeah. Remember iJustine? I mean, that's how iJustine gained her, like, first bits of notoriety was she did what we would now call, like, a YouTube video. It might have been YouTube. I don't know. Whatever it was. But she did a video. She published a video showing her, you know, 5,000-page phone bill after her first month with the iPhone, because they were AT&T or Singular at the time, was detailing line by line every time you use data. And it was like, yeah, that's not so good. Not so good. Don't. Yeah, exactly. All right. Moving on. Fernando has a question, and I hope maybe we have an answer. Fernando in Discord asks, in Apple Mail, I keep seeing recovered a mailbox named recovered messages iCloud in parentheses. So it's recovered messages parentheses iCloud. And I see this on my Mac routinely, and it is completely empty when I click on it. I delete it and it keeps coming back no matter how many times. Does anyone know what might be happening or how to fix it? And there was a discussion. Jamcycler commented correctly, at least as far as I know, and said, normally recovered messages mailboxes are created when the process of you or your Mac moving messages between mailboxes fails for one reason or another, and it stashes them there. It says, look, I was trying to move these. Something happened. I don't want you to lose these messages, so I'm going to go put them here. You figure out if they wound up getting moved to where you wanted them or not. As Jamcycler points out, if there were any messages in there, you might be able to figure out when and where that failure happened. But if there's no messages, you don't get to know. He does recommend rebuilding the iCloud inbox. And that's an interesting piece of advice. So you can do this in Mail. You go into Mail, highlight a mailbox, go to Mailbox and choose Rebuild. I think you can also right click on a mailbox and choose Rebuild. that will, depending on what type of mailbox it is, if it's an IMAP mailbox, a rebuild means that it will essentially wipe out the contents, the local cache of that mailbox, and re-download it, treating the server as truth. You might need to do this for multiple of your mailboxes. And I would also do it for, if I see a recovered messages mailbox and it's empty, I would rebuild that too, because that would reload it from the disk. There might be an issue with your mail index that is causing it to not see things. And you can delete your mail index too. Onyx does this fairly well. If you don't want to have to go into the Finder, you could do it in the Finder too. You quit mail and then go delete all the into the mail. Like you go to home, library, mail, and I think it's like V10 now because that's the version we're up to. And then in there, it might be one folder deep. I'm doing this from memory. There are envelope index files that store mail's index. You can delete those and then relaunch mail and it will rebuild them. The good news is, and the reason I don't remember it, is that you don't have to. Onyx does this, and you can choose to have Onyx just tell those files to rebuild or to delete them and force mail to recreate them. In most scenarios, I would choose to recreate, because if there's damage to the database, then there's no reason to mess with that. So, but yeah, it seems like there's something missing out there. I don't know what that is. I don't know. You guys have any thoughts on this? Seems like nothing. Nothing. All right.
Hey, Dave.
Yes,
hey, Pete. Can we jump ahead in time or go back in time? Actually, go back in time.
Sure.
So Porthos John, it came up on the last topic we were discussing.
Yeah.
You can create a shortcut to set low data and put it, create an automation on that.
Oh.
Brilliant.
I didn't realize that was a scriptable option.
Yeah.
Because not everything is.
Right.
Create a shortcut to set low data mode. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And put it in automation.
And put it in automations and have it automate, you know, once a day.
Yeah.
At 4 a.m. every day, set low data
or mode. Even geolocate when I'm not home.
You know? Oh, yeah.
All kinds of different options.
Yes. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant, Porthos John. Thank you for that.
Oh, I love that. Oh, this is why I love doing the show live. This is great. It sometimes gets distracting, right. And sometimes it means the agenda has to flow and, you know, it has to flow circularly. But that's okay. It's fine. We learn things. I love learning things, like especially like
just
that.
Just think of timelines as not being linear. You'll be fine.
You're totally fine. No problem whatsoever. Circling back yet again to using Onyx to clean things up. I was having an issue on my Mac Mini in the office, which is running Ventura, where once an hour, my CPUs, now this is an M1 Mini, so it has 8 cores, 4 efficiency cores and 4, you know, high performance cores. Once an hour, all 8 cores would peg for 90 seconds, maybe a little more. And like I could do nothing. If I was on a Zoom call or something, I would completely go like, you know, all jittery. Like my computer was not mine to use for those 90 seconds to 2 minutes or whatever it was. If I was fortunate enough to have launched Activity Monitor or something where I could see what processes were being used beforehand, I would see that it was, you know, Core Spotlight or MD Worker or something just going nuts. And this seemed like a lot. And what I also would notice was right before this happened, I would see BusyCal, if it was visible, even if it was in the background, kind of flash and refresh. And so it was clearly something about Spotlight, you know, maybe related to the calendar. I couldn't quite figure it out. And I mentioned to John Gotow, the author of the proprietor of St. Clair Software, so the author of like Default Folder, but also the author of AppTamer. We were emailing about something else, and I said, yeah, it's ridiculous that I'm using AppTamer on my M1. I shouldn't have to, but I have to keep Core Spotlight D or whatever it is under control, because otherwise I lose my computer for 2 minutes an hour, and I don't get to pick what those 2 minutes are. And, you know, like any of us would do, he starts throwing out ideas and solutions. And one of the things he suggested, which I had already done, but not the way he suggested it, was he said, have you rebuilt your spotlight index? I'm like, well, of course I have. But it didn't help this problem. But I rebuilt it using Onyx. So I don't actually know what command it ran. It did do the whole thing where it, after I chose to rebuild it, it then re-indexed things. Like I saw the re-indexing happen. So something happened, but it did not solve this problem. And John said, because he's a helpful dude and a smart guy, he shared the three command line commands that he would issue to fix this, using the MD util command, turning off indexing on all volumes, erasing indexing on all volumes, and then re-indexing on all volumes, and re-enabling indexing on all volumes. And so, you know, of course, being at my wit's end on this, I'm willing to try anything. I was like, yeah, I'll do that. So I did that. And the problem, I don't want to say the problem is completely gone, but it is 99% gone, in that I still see it once an hour do something, but the spike lasts for maybe a second, not 90 to 100 of these seconds. So livable. The other thing John said was, or suggested, was rebuilding the index on my Time Machine volume. And that could be, that could explain the once an hour thing and all of that, right? But I thought it was interesting that whatever Onyx is doing was different than these commands that John shared with me. So I reshare them. They will be in the show notes. You just issue them one after another, and they will be in the show notes for this episode at Geekab 981, which you can find at MacGeekab.com, or go straight to mgg.fm/981. Have you guys seen either of this on any of this on your Ventura machines, by the way?
I have not.
No, okay.
It sounds terrifying. No.
It sucks. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, here we go again.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It sucks. So it's mostly better now, but I'm still not real bullish on Ventura for a variety of reasons, this being added to that list.
Ventura, Vista, what's a few letters among friends?
Dude, ain't that the truth. I wish for the days when Apple did not feel obligated to release an entirely new version of its operating systems annually. And it's funny because Apple bailed out of Macworld Expo because they didn't like one of the things. I mean, there were a variety of reasons that gave them the flexibility to do this, the internet being one, where they didn't have to go and meet their customers face to face anymore. You know, you go to their website and learn about the products. But they didn't like being tied to the schedule of having to release products at Macworld Expo every year and make a big splash. But all that happened was they shifted that from January to June, because now they got to release new operating systems. Four of them or something, maybe five, you know, every single June. And then developers get to spend the summer working on it. It's like, could we have one like this year?
Yeah, right. You really don't have to release, you know.
No, in fact,
what, security patches.
Yeah, just patches. Like stability patches. Just that. Don't worry about the new features. Just stability. Release a new operating system every couple of years, every 3 years, you know, but this every year thing. And look at the new bells and whistles we added. Well, yeah, you broke the stuff that actually matters to us. I don't know. That's my.
I mean, the nice thing is that you can specify security updates only. And I think I have that on a couple of my machines.
Well, for auto updates.
Mm-hmm. For auto. Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
But if Apple keeps updating the operating system, there are apps and things that it, like all these features that they do add. Now my devices are out of sync. There have been times, it's not current, but there have been times where you couldn't sync calendars between the old version of, you know, last year's macOS and this year's iOS. Well, if I buy a new iPhone, I'm forced to use the new software. Or if I buy a new Mac, I'm forced to use, I can't roll a new Mac back, right? You got to use the current thing. But like I understand having to keep everything up to date and in sync. I just wish the updates were a little more thoughtful instead of just based on a calendar year and Apple feeling like they have to do this. And maybe they do have to do this to remain competitive. Like, I don't know. But Mac OS doesn't need to be updated every year to remain competitive. iOS might need to be, or at least having features added. You know, like, there's different competition markets here. But Mac OS, dude, Monterey is great. Monterey is great.
My biggest gripe with Ventura is somebody felt the need to change the UI majorly, like settings and all that.
The settings UI.
Where's the thing that I used to know where to go to fix? Or
They did that, though, to more coincide with iOS. So it was the same terminology across, right? Yeah. I mean, that's
they still moved settings up, from, they ported settings from iOS to the Mac, right? This wasn't new. It was just,
significantly different.
Yes, it's different for sure. Yeah. Yeah. But Monterey's great. I don't know.
Yeah, good luck getting it on a new M2. Oh,
you won't. That's the thing. Like, if Apple doesn't fix the aggregate device issue that Ventura has, I cannot use anything newer than Monterey for the podcast without either changing the entirety of my workflow. And I don't even know what that would look like in order to do the show live. Like, I think I have to use aggregate devices, but maybe not. Maybe there's a way that I could engineer things and not do that. Or I have to keep buying Macs. Like, if I want to upgrade from Intel in the studio to Apple Silicon, the M1 series is the latest I can go. None of the M2 chips run on machines that will run anything earlier than Ventura. And right. So I would need like an M1 mini, or I think the Mac Studio, because that's the M1 family, like the M1 Pro and the M1 Max, that will run Monterey. So, but it's like, that's it. The list of computers that I can run Monterey on is now fixed. You know,
well, now you have to go buy a studio, Dave.
I might. I've actually thought about it just to right. buy myself time. Because eventually Apple will change core audio again and break something different, but fix this. You know what I mean? And so it's like, okay, good. Yeah. I can jump. Yeah. But Ventura ain't it. And I'm not convinced that whatever they release, this year will be it. So, but maybe, who knows?
Right.
Anyway, John, speaking of hardware and Apple and all that, you want to take us to Tom?
Okay, I guess we have a few minutes.
You want to wait? You want to save Tom and just do some cool stuff found? Let's do that. Let's save Tom, because that's probably a longer conversation.
Yes.
All right. I will share my cool stuff found for this week, which is the Sonos Era 300. I mentioned it at the end of last week's episode. This is a fascinating speaker. It's really unlike anything I've ever experienced from Sonos before. First of all, just the way that it looks it's kind of like somebody took an oval, three-dimensional oval speaker and put a belt in the middle of it and cinched it up. It's kind of got this hourglass kind of shape to it. And what's interesting is it sort of sits on its side. So when you're facing it, you see this oval view. You look down and you see the hourglass. The front of it is a speaker grill. And then the back half of the hourglass part is also a speaker grill. And this thing's got a ton of different speakers inside it, because as a single speaker, it is built to do like multi-channel sound. It will play Dolby Atmos music. And it's fascinating. When I started using this, the first thing I played was an Atmos version of Tom Petty's Free Fallin', which starts with that kind of chimey acoustic guitar. And it sounded like that was coming from behind the speaker. It was like, oh, wait, this is really interesting. And then when the band kicked in, that was in front of the speaker. And this thing's tiny. It sounds way bigger than it is. Standing 5 feet away from it, it sounds very deep. Like, the depth of where the sound is coming from sounds much farther away than the speaker, where I know the speaker to be and can see with my eyes. 10 feet away from it, it sounds like there are two speakers 10 feet apart, right? The way that it sort of sends sound out to the side, and you can set the height of it. Out of the box, the low end of this speaker wasn't huge. It was kind of tame and almost lacking a little. But Sonos has this thing called TruePlay, where you tune the speaker to your room. With the Era, that with the initial version of TruePlay, which is what exists on most of their speakers, you use your iPhone and walk around the room like waving your phone up and down like it's some kind of
like
divining
rod. Look like a crazy person, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Like I'm looking for water, you know, or whatever, with my phone up and down for 60 seconds. It's a fascinating exercise, but it's... And during that time, the speaker's like sending all sorts of sounds out, right? You know, and your phone's picking them up and it knows that it's moving around because your iPhone has a gyroscope in it. And so it tunes the speaker to your room, and that works great. It's amazing. You can do that with the Era 300, but you can also let the speaker tune itself to the room. So I thought, well, let me just do that, because it, like the HomePod, you know, it has microphones in it for Sonos Voice and the A-Lady and all that stuff. So I let it tune itself to the room. It did that. And then suddenly the low end was exactly where I wanted it to be. It was great. So like really interesting speaker. And like I said, it does have voice control. It can be used as your rear speakers if you have like a Sonos Arc or something for in your living room. But by itself, it is not a speaker that can be used easily with your TV. You could probably route things around and force it to be, but it's certainly not meant to be used that way. But as I only have one of them, so I can't try it as rear speakers, but it would be cool to use it as rears and see how far away it makes like the rear sound. So
yeah.
I might have to grab another one. Yeah. But it's really interesting. It's, you know, where they've got speakers sort of all around this thing. It's $450 for, I have the price right on that. $449. Yep. In the US. And you can order it now.
Pre-answered my question. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Pre-answered my question. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cause I was out in the yard about 3 days ago with the move, and I was and that was, you know, 6 or 8 feet away from me. And I'm like, that is an amazing speaker. The low end on that is awesome. But this sounds like it's even more technologically advanced.
It is. You could use it outside. I don't think they would say that it's waterproof. I'm pretty sure they haven't, although it might be. They say it's humidity resistant, which is important.
Yeah.
Whereas
the Move, you can drop, it can rain on it and all that stuff.
Right. I mean, well, and the Move is also a battery-powered speaker. This is not. Yep. This needs to be plugged in. So it's a little different. Where I would use this is in like a bedroom or an office or or in your kitchen, right, where you're going to be listening to music a lot and you want to put one speaker in and have it sort of fill the room. That's where this is key to me, is that it could go in the living room if you using something different to watch TV, you know, and you want this as your, you know, music listening kind of, you know, in the study, the family room, that sort of thing. I'm impressed with this thing. Yeah. It. I didn't know what to think about it, and then I pressed play, and I was like, "Oh, okay, that's pretty cool." So, yeah. Yet again, Sonos kind of impresses me, which I didn't know. I didn't know that they could do. So, yeah.
Sounds like it's taking the Bose Wave technology and crushing it on top. Well, not taking their technology, but improving upon what they were doing.
Yes.
And making it more better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. John, what do you got?
All right. This is the first time I've seen this at Pepcom. It is the Skoshi.
Skosh is how they pronounce it. Yep.
Sorry. That's Skosh.
That's her name.
PowerVolt Travel 30.
Okay.
30 watt USB 2-in-1 home and car travel charger. And I can show you. So I'm holding it here, and Dave also has a picture up. But look at this thing.
You got to describe it, because most people are never going to see what we're
it's
seeing.
It's a square about 2x2, 2 inch by 2 inch. And it's square. And here are the two parts. So this is the car part.
Nope. What's the car part, John?
The car part.
You know what? Put it down. Put it down and just describe it as though someone can't see it. I'll put a picture of it.
That plugs into your car energy or cigarette lighter.
Great.
And the other one is a two-prong that plugs in your wall outlet.
Oh, amazing. And it is
100 through 240 volts, so it is truly a travel charger. So if you can get the adapter from the flat blade to whatever the country you're in uses, it's a true travel charger.
And what is it? What kind of power does it output?
30 watts.
30 watts, single port?
Yes, there's one USB-C port.
Got it. Ah, cool. What's the price on that? Oh, I see it here.
$44.99 you can probably get.
Yeah.
Huh. It's just always nice. I mean, it's really light. It's really small. And I even hooked it up to my MacBook and looked in the system info power, and it's like 30 watts. Mm. I'm like, okay. So you could use it to charge your laptop.
Oh, yeah.
It may take a bit longer than other devices. But, hey, it's small and easy to travel with.
Well, it depends on your laptop. Like, the MacBook Air is almost built to be used with a 30-watt charger. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's great. Ah, I like that. I like the kind of the two-in-one little deal. Pretty cool. Yeah, that would be good to have, like you said, for the car, especially traveling, because you plug it into a car and charge. rental car or whatever.
The only thing I can't figure out is, that's not it. How do I replace the fuse?
Is there a fuse in there?
Well, there should be. I mean, any device that I know that, has a car charging port has a fuse in there in case.
Well, is it a fuse or is it a circuit breaker? Like that resets when you pull power from it or something?
It could be.
Right? I mean,
my experience has been any of these car chargers have a fuse of some value in there to protect you.
Did you ask him about that last night when you saw him?
No.
All right. Well, now you know what to ask him. Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. Let me jump in real quick then because he was talking about the international part here, and I'll put it in the show notes, but I found one on Walmart for $9.36, and it will plug into Europe, China, UK, Universal. I found it on Walmart, the Velotoy all-in-one travel plug adapter, universal worldwide, US, UK, Australia, European Union. And I use something similar to that. I take with me and plug right into. So I'll put the link real quickly in the show notes.
I think we got it for you, Pete. We're a real-time operation
full service. Yeah, man.
That's
so,
right.
Because he said, yeah, it's international. Yes, it is. It will go international. It looks light and
cool. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, I'll put the Velotoy in there. That's great. We have time for one more thing, and I have had this on the Cool Stuff Found list for probably weeks. Should have had it on the Cool Stuff Found list for a year. And it is the, specifically the CatLink robot litter box. Talk about a life changing piece of technology. And we bought this for ourselves. In fact, after we bought one, we very, very quickly bought a second one. I had reached out to the litter robot people, sort of the name brand of that world. And they were like, yeah, we don't have any review units to send out. And I was like, okay, no problem. Like, that's fine. They will rue the day, because what we realized is that by having to go through the process and, buy it like we all do for things, we realized that the litter robot is not worth what they charge for it, because you can get this CatLink for probably 20 to 30% less than the litter robot. It has an app, links to your Wi-Fi, will tell you when it needs to be, emptied or whatever. But it's amazing. The cat goes in, does its business, leaves. You can set the amount of time that it waits. We have it set to 3 minutes. 3 minutes later, the box rotates around, empties itself, and it's perfectly clean for the cat or cat's next visit. And so we've got one upstairs and one downstairs in the house. We've gone from having 5 litter boxes to just these two. We could probably get away with just one, but we didn't want to test that theory when we had four cats living at the house, our three plus our son's one. But yeah, this thing's amazing. We have a model that they don't sell anymore. They were selling for like $499. That was like the CatLink regular versus the CatLink Pro. However, there is the CatLink Lite, which is on Indiegogo right now, and you can get for less than $400. I think $359 or $379, depending on where you go with that. And it's they've kind of made the thing work and a little more economically. And so it's yeah, there you go. So anyway, couldn't help but share because this thing is amazing. If you've got cats, I already know that you dislike having to empty the litter box all the time. And so, and of course, if you don't keep up with it, your cats will choose to go elsewhere sometimes, and that's never good. This is one of the least fun parts about owning a cat, and this thing takes it away entirely. We maybe go and mess with the thing once a week now, and yet our cats are always using perfectly clean litter boxes. So,
unless you enjoy the smell of ammonia.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's no more smell. Like, it just, you know, we had our son's cat, for whatever reason, he does not feel the need. He was never taught to bury before he leaves the box. And so that was fun. You know, and I think that may have been sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, because we've been talking about these for a while. It was finally like, all right, well, we got to fix it. Like, this is not okay. And it really, if you've got cats, get a robot litter box. You know, whatever one you get, you're probably going to be equally as thrilled about it as what I'm talking about here. But don't discount the CatLink just because they are discounted on the price. It really is fantastic, and it's been working for us for probably 6 months, if not more. Probably more like 7 or 8 months. So good stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who's that in the background? The band.
It is the band. I thought maybe a cat had walked in here. I was like, oh, I've never brought my cat over to the studio. I used to bring one of my cats to the office. Nope, it's just the band hanging out here in the studio with us on this 80 degree day. I'm going to go check out Tideline House for lunch, Pete. So that's the new food truck pod thing that opened here in Durham. So really stoked about that. Yeah. All right. We got anything else to tell them? Is it time to go? I think it's time to go. No. That silence speaks volumes. Thanks for hanging out with us, folks. Yep. Thanks to CashFly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Go check out our podcasts, the ones we do when we're not doing this show. I do two. I do Business Brain for entrepreneurs, Gig Gab for musicians. Pete does So There I Was for aviation enthusiasts. Go check it out. Go check out our merch at mattgeekup.com/merch. And there's more coming that you can get one if you have been watching the video, like Pete's t-shirt. And if you haven't, go to mattgeekup.com/merch. You can see. It's right there. Maybe we'd get a picture of Pete, put it up as the model. I like it. Make sure to check out our sponsors, which are always at mattgeekup.com/sponsors. Of course, you can go to barebones.com to learn about BB Edit and download your free trial. You can go to piavpn.com/mgg and sign up for it's a fantastic VPN. I'm still happy with it a year plus later, or whatever it is. Thanks for hanging out, folks. John, what's my shirt say?
If it flies, it spies.
All right, good. What's Pete's shirt say?
Don't get caught.
I think I had it going. Almost got caught on the sound.
Made
it. It's good advice, folks. Good advice. Later.